Okay, if everyone would please take their seat. Sorry for the delay. We're just trying to get things. We're trying to confirm that we are streaming, but we'll go ahead. I'm Gene Lozano, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. I want to welcome you all here this morning. I think the next few hours, I think you'll find that it will be very interesting and informative. And you're going to actually have an opportunity to provide us input on issues affecting you day-to-day with transit facilities and so forth. Before we start, get an overview. Bernice, as president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision, would you like to say anything?
I just want to welcome everybody, especially CCLV members, and Gene has gotten us a really good program this morning, and I'm so glad that we could, when we have a national guest, we like to be able to use them for our special interest and committee work. And Paul Schrader is certainly a gem.
Thank you, Bernice. We're going to have two parts this morning, and the second part will be at approximately 10:30 a.m., at which time we're going to have Marilyn Golden, policy analyst from Dredith, who will be having to interact with us via the telephone because of conflicting schedule and some medical restrictions have been imposed upon her for travel right at this moment. Marilyn is going to talk to you briefly about paratransit, but be a resource. This is your opportunity to ask every question you've ever wanted to ask about paratransit. And she is one of the top people in the country on this subject. Dredith, who she represents, has had a lot of lawsuits. It's been involved with a lot of the change there. So that is something to look forward to, and you'll be able to ask her questions through the telephone. Okay. Now, our first part, as Bernice told you, we've invited Paul Schrader to come to us. As you know, he is the Vice President of Programs and Policies for the American Foundation for the Blind. He has oversight of the programmatic efforts that AFB performs in areas of aging, education, employment, literacy, and technology. Also, he oversees their research efforts and agendas. Those of you who have been around with the council for years will know that in the 1990s, Paul worked for the American Council of the Blind for 3 years. That's where I got to know Paul, on dealing with issues with architectural barriers. He had other things to do. Paul and I have been to a lot of different meetings on detectable warnings and signage and guide strips and stair striping and so forth, and actually going out in the field, and had to slug it out in antsy meetings, those good old days. prior to that, Paul was he was the special programs coordinator for the office, the governor's office of advocacy for persons with disabilities in Columbus, Ohio, where he did numerous things there. Paul attended an American university where he got a bachelor's degree in public science and international studies. Now, political science, sorry. Paul has been asked to do a two-part thing this morning. He's going to kind of give an over historical perspective of transportation, especially since the implementation of the ADA and how that's with the focus on wayfinding, where we were and where we're now. And then he's going to get into kind of conducting a focus group as to finding out what is it that we're wanting when it comes to the wayfinding through transit facilities. So I'm going to turn it over to Paul. He's totally in charge of it for the remainder of our time until about 10:30 approximately. Here's the mic.
I'm going to stand up for it.
Oh, you got a mic here, too.
Yes, I'm going to take this one up. Got okay. Here. At least I'll stand up for a minute to make sure I stay awake. It's probably good for me. So, Gene, thanks so much for that. It was great to get to work with Gene Lozano up close in the early 90s on detectable warnings. And, in fact, my daughter, who's now 19, just turned 19 last Sunday, as a matter of fact, remembers fondly her dad walking around the house with various kinds of detectable warning dome tiles. Some kids get toys, and we've got a wireless. Oh, I'll switch to that. And some kids get detectable warning tiles for presents. And so, we're bringing them up right in the Schrader household. So, and oddly enough, for those of you who have been around ACB for a while, Hannah, my daughter, is working with Nolan Crabb at Ohio State University. Nolan, of course, used to be the editor of the Braille Forum. I used to work with him in that capacity and learned a lot. He has this story to tell that I think actually is the other way around, but Nolan's a pretty humble guy. So he remembers back in the early 90s I came into his office one day and I said, Nolan, I don't know if this internet's going to amount to anything much, but we need to get on board and see. And because I think it's going to be something special. I think it was the other way. I think he was the one that convinced me that the internet was actually going to be something worth our time. But that's not our topic today. It is transportation. Gene wanted to say something about the history of transportation, so I thought I'd go back to Homer, because apparently he was pissed at Ulysses a lot because he never did call stops and he was a terrible sighted guide. That's where a lot of this goes back to. We're still fighting those there. Now, I won't go back that far, but I will sketch just a few things by way of overview, and then I do really want to have a conversation this morning about what we should be doing about transportation, community access, because there are lots of challenging issues. In a sense, I guess this topic can be kind of divided into a couple things. Things that sort of we're in charge of, that we can do, that we can control, and things that are kind of done to us that we don't really get to control so much, or we only have minimal control over. So let's talk about the first key meaningful development, other than perhaps the invention of the telescope and lenses, and I don't remember enough high school science to walk through all that stuff, was the work with the white cane and the development of laws regarding cane, and then the development of mobility experience and expertise regarding teaching people how to use the cane effectively. And of course, at the same time, people were learning how to use dog guides effectively. I'm not going to spend very much time on that topic, except to say that obviously this falls under that heading of things that we can do, things that we have control over. Learning how to use the cane effectively, learning how to use any other personal device effectively in travel is something that we do have control over, but something that has not been without controversy. Some of you may remember or know people who, back in the early days of cane travel, for example, were taught to hold their cane out kind of like a spear. I'm tempted to do that sometimes now. I refrain. Because it was essentially seen as an identity thing, right? I mean, so you hold it out straight, people could see it, and drivers. I mean, and this was particularly important as car travel was taking a toll on all of us. And so that, of course, changed as people got to understand that there's actually a use for this device that has far better implications than for identity, and in fact is a great information device. The arguments over cane use are not entirely settled. And it's funny to me that these have continued for so many years. And if you, the American Foundation for the Blind publishes a journal called the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness, JVIB, and there still are articles that carry on some of these arguments. But I think most of us here in the group know them, starting with whether blind people themselves could teach cane travel and should teach cane travel, and that is only somewhat recently settled in terms of the profession. I suppose the professionalization of cane travel was controversial at one time. We owe a lot, most of us who are cane users, owe a debt of gratitude to the veterans and to the folks post-World War II who really developed a lot of the skills and techniques that we now take for granted in cane travel. But, you know, that's a fairly recent vintage. People still argue over cane length, hand position, glide touch. I'm sort of tempted when I see all these things about length, hand position, and glide touch to think we're in sex ed and not cane travel. But maybe one of these days I'll write a piece for JVIB on that. I don't know. It'll be have a little fun with it. Because you know, mobility people don't have enough fun. I don't know. They just need a little more humor in their lives. Anyway, so there's still have those debates. But and I'm not gonna. I don't think that's the purpose of today's discussion. I think most of us as individuals sort of settle those things for ourselves and what works best, and you know, we have to trust in our own judgment. But this cane debate still rattles on. Under this same heading have been the devices that have been used, and I would say only moderately successful. Again, I'm focusing primarily on people who don't use vision for travel. So when I talk about devices, and I mean the various sonar-based or laser-based techniques that provide sounds or tactile impressions, things that you can either attach to your cane or hold in your hand to provide you with some information about the environment that the cane isn't giving you, like what's at head level and stuff like that, and also a further distance on of barriers that might be in your path. You know, I don't think most of us have found those to be very successful. Some people use them well, but I don't really think those technologies have taken hold to any great degree. The challenge of getting around independently and safely then really is a mix of these two aspects: the things that we can control, the things that we can have in our environment to give us the information that we need, whether it's a cane or whether it's appropriate use of lenses or dog guides, and these things that are external, that are not in our control so much. And that's, I want to turn to that for a second, and that's the other half of the equation. And so for no particular reason, but just because it seemed logical, I thought I'd divide this into a couple of areas. The first one being sort of community-level issues. Signage, traffic signals. How do we get around the community independently? Now, to be up here talking about this in trying to provide some history with Gene Lozano sitting next to me is sort of like trying to talk religion with the Pope sitting next to you. I mean, he's actually done all this stuff, and I've just been a sidekick on occasion, watching him work and trying to put together a good argument on occasion to support what he was trying to do for ACB. But there are obviously a number of approaches that have been taken as we have begun to try to use technology more effectively, you know, over the last 80 years or so in providing access to the environment. Probably the first really meaningful external use of technology would be the traffic signals. And many of us probably remember somewhere encountering bells, buzzers, chirps, etc. I think a lot of folks probably encountered chirps because those were chirps and cuckoos. And that's not just the board meeting we're talking about. Okay, I had to have something for that, you know. I had to draw on cuckoo somewhere. So we've experienced those early implementations of trying to give us additional information about traffic flow. And a lot of arguments at the time, of course, of whether blind people needed these assists or whether they didn't. And again, for the moment anyway, that's not what I'm arguing about. I'm simply painting a picture of what we had. But I think most of us recognized that that information was moderately useful, but the environment was dramatically different. And so 80 years ago, as traffic signals were being used to control increases in car travel, traffic signals were themselves pretty primitive. And for the most part, a blind person with moderate training and a bit of luck probably could navigate with or without assistance from the audible traffic signal. As traffic signals became much more complex, as the need to move cars more efficiently around our communities became much more of an issue, I think all of us would agree, even those who were not in favor of audible signals in the past, would agree that there are now times and places where even the very well-trained and very expert and one might even say brave traveler can benefit from and perhaps needs an audible signal to provide extra information. And so we have much more clever signals that have been developed that provide much more information about the street crossing, about timing, about the placement of the signal itself for activation, and things of that sort. And so we have this external work that's been going on, some of it in the U.S. and much of it elsewhere in the world, that has developed into a body of knowledge about how to make street crossings more accessible where there are audible signals. It's not perfect, and you know the traffic planners keep several steps ahead of us by coming up with ever more complex ways to move cars around mm-hmm. and make it almost impossible for pedestrians to move safely. I personally find roundabouts and such things extraordinarily frightening. So the environment continues to be a challenge. And one of the things I want to talk about this morning as we get into our interactive phase is what we do about this. Because we have really two principal challenges that's going to come up over and over again when we talk about these external technologies. One is, do we have the technologies that we need? And number two, do we have the money and access to the funding that's needed to make it possible? Is there enough investment, and how do we secure appropriate investment? Well, work has also been going on in the signage area, because after all, we like to know where we are. One of the puzzling things I find as I've gotten older, and my wife tells me I've gotten a lot more grumpy about sighted people, which is true, is that sighted people actually never know where they are. I don't know how they get around. I mean, they're precious to me. I admire sighted people. Somehow they get around never knowing where they are. I think it's remarkable. But they seem to manage with never knowing. They've got all these signs in the environment that are built for them, which they never seem to know where they are. They never seem to be able to read. And so somehow somehow they manage, and God love them for it, because they're just brave people, by golly. So, Bernice is going to hit me. I can see it. I can see she's going to do it. She's going to make me shut up. No. Anyway, so
I said you were a gem.
So there's all this issue of signage, and most blind people that I know tend to really like to know street signs and things of that sort because it's a great orientation cue. I know we kid around right in our community that best way to get directions for anybody is to ask a blind person, because they're going to give you the kind of detail that people need. So we like street signs, but street signs have not been really available or accessible to us independently before. So we've had to sort of memorize where things are and stuff like that, and we haven't really had a solution for that. Well, the same is true for building identification, whether it's street address or identification by building name, any of those signs. None of these have been heretofore available until the last, 20, 25 years or so, with the onset of talking signs and various technologies that use transmitters and receivers to convey that kind of information, to convey static signage information. And so we are beginning to have, in some parts of the country, more probably out west in certain cities than anywhere else, the beginning usage of these kinds of signs. Now, I think one of the same two questions I asked a minute ago apply. Is the technology the right technology? Is the investment available? And is it something we want to have happen to give us access to this kind of information? There is a third question, though, and it sort of leads me into a side topic, and that's GPS. But the third question for both of these is, how many handheld things do you want to carry? And it's a reasonable question, I think, that we need to talk about. Because these kinds of signage information are handheld receiver dependent, pretty much. Obviously, GPS systems are handheld, require a handheld receiver. And some are also exploring, I think, the use of handhelds for audible signal information. To try to get at a couple of things. One is more specific information for the person who needs it. And secondly, there are those who find audible signals annoying in the environment. And it's just a plain reality. So, and, you know, we have to deal with that. So, handhelds is a third part of this technology equation that I think we need to get at. Now, just to quickly sort of wrap on the GPS thing, because I'm not a GPS user. I think it's fascinating. I think it's awesome. I just don't happen to be one who uses it. I do a lot of other things that probably distract me too much from when I'm walking around. So I'm not sure that I would be a good candidate for GPS, except for the fact that I surely would love to know the answers to those questions of where am I and what's around me on a more consistent basis. And I think we all would. Those questions pop up all the time, probably have maybe since Homer's time, but certainly more recently, the where am I and what's around me questions. And GPS is wonderful and beautiful and ideal for answering those kinds of questions, especially because it takes advantage of developments that are wanted by everybody. They're taking advantage of mainstream developments. We didn't have to develop satellites for blind people. Would have been kind of fun. I think Gene would have been into it. Might have been building a satellite, but we didn't have to do that because other people needed it, chiefly the military. We didn't have to develop the kind of triangulation or whatever is used for GPS location, because others wanted that for commercial reasons, again, and also for military reasons. So that we were able to dovetail nicely on this technology. And now, going back to my friends, the sighted, who never know where they are or what's around them, they like GPS too for the same reasons, because they don't know either what's around them. And so for them, points of interest is really helpful too, because they would obviously miss the building that's right in front of them, which they always do when I ask for the street address for the building that apparently turns out was right in front of them. So GPS helpful for all of us, but has the limitations that I mentioned, and of course the additional one, which is true for all of these technologies, but especially for GPS, and that's the expense. It's not cheap. It's getting cheaper, especially as it migrates into the cell phone platform, but it doesn't come without expense. Let me move then to transit, because obviously that's the other big kahuna. Walking and getting around the community is a big issue, and there's things happening to make that happen. And transit, moving around faster and farther, has always been and will probably always be with us as an issue, unless, of course, we develop the personal vehicle thing, which may or may not. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, but who knows? So public transit access It didn't, of course, start with the Americans with Disabilities Act, but one might say that the Americans with Disabilities Act was sort of bastardize something. It was the Californication of what you all were doing in many ways, because if you look at the ADA, it's a lot of stuff that you guys had already developed in California for things like stop calling and requirements for accessible signage and, of course, detectable warnings. So a lot of the work that went into making public transit accessible through the ADA really has its roots here in California and a few other places, but a lot of roots here. We haven't solved this problem. I don't know very many systems in this country that I've experienced where I can, as a blind person, reliably know for sure what stop I'm at and whether I'll know the stop to get off, whether it's a bus or a fixed route, you know, rail type system. We have transit systems that have very imaginative ways of hiding that information. So even where there are automatic announcements, they're garbled. If they're dependent on the driver, then they're fraught with human error. And in a way, and I'm not really beating up on the drivers, because frankly, I'd rather them drive and focus on what's going on moving these vehicles around and have the systems be automated. But because I don't really think that's a good task for drivers to be doing for the constant stop calling, whether it's in a train or a bus or whatever. But in any event, it hasn't worked that well when it's human, and it often doesn't work that well when it's automated. I mean, how many times have we been in a situation where at the very moment when things are loudest is when the automatic announcement goes off and there's no chance of hearing it? And if you're using the same system every day, it might not be as big a deal because you kind of get to know when your stop is. And, you know, we kind of have a sense of that. But it's just one of those frustrations, and all of us, I suspect, have had the situation where we've gone well beyond our stop and have had to scramble a day to try to get back or figure out where the heck we are and figure out if there is an easy way back. And so stop calling has not been adequately solved. Identification of the vehicles and the routes, again, whether it's a bus or a train, have not been adequately resolved for much the same reasons. Human error or a failure of technology to really be used properly and adequately. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's that it isn't used properly. And I think the same is true for people with usable vision trying to interpret the signs that are on vehicles. It's a hit or miss proposition. Again, not because it can't be made more accessible, but because it simply hasn't been. The Americans with Disabilities Act gave us the tools that we need to try to push back and try to improve this system. I think prior to ADA, you know, there might have been some state laws, but for the most part, it was really people who had to build up cred, street cred, on advisory committees and things like that. And a lot of people did. I mean, they did some good stuff to get better bus signage for people who could see some, to get stop calling put in place, to get indicators of bus stops so that you could actually clearly identify where the bus stop was. Obviously, the detectable warnings. So a lot of this stuff was put in place prior to ADA because people worked hard and hustled and, you know, maybe had some state help, but mostly, I think, just worked hard and hustled. Well, now we've got a law and a set of regulations that help us to require these things, and yet I still don't think we've made the improvements that most of us, I think, hoped we would be able to get out of public transit. The situation is in flux here as well because, again, systems are beginning to invest in GPS technologies, public transit systems now I'm talking about, which are particularly valuable for buses, and as a result in information that is delivered over an internet platform. Why do they do this? Well, they do this because everyone has some of the same complaints we do. Where the hell is the bus? When is it going to get here? And where does this route go? And so We now have transit systems that are investing in GPS and internet platforms to be able to provide that information to cell phones and PDAs and things like that so that people can real-time figure out where their bus is and make some decisions about what they're going to do for getting to work or getting to school or wherever it is that they're going. Obviously, we can take advantage of those too, although there are some limitations. Obviously, the systems have to be accessible, of course, and we have to be able to know how to do that. For example, some of the bus systems, they have specific numbers at the at that particular bus stop sign. Well, those numbers are generally not something that we can either read easily, and they're not usually in an accessible format in any event. So, technology, again, not really in our control entirely for transit systems and for being able to use transit independently. And yet, the prospects are there for a much better environment for accessing the transit that we have. And to sort of be Donald Rumsfeldian, you know, you only have the transportation that you have. And that is a problem, I recognize. We do not have a great transit system in this country, by and large, for getting around our local municipalities. But we have the transit system that we have. And I think one of the topics that, as an organized community, we continue to work on is generally being supportive of public transit as an important option for everybody, an important investment in our communities. Along with that, we need to make sure that the public transit that is developed is as easy to use, as flexible as possible, and gives us as much of the information that we need as possible. And I think there's no doubt that we can do better, and there's no doubt that some of the investment in technologies can help make that happen. So here's what I want to do, and Jean and Bernice, help me as you wish with this. I'd love to have a little bit of conversation about how we move forward from here. You know, we have a scattered system that provides some accessibility, and in some cases a fair amount of accessibility in terms of giving us the information that we need to be independent. We have excellent tools for some things, and we have excellent instruction for some things. So certainly people who are taught to use the cane properly and taught to use dog guides properly and taught to use assistive lenses properly can travel extraordinarily well. Those tools are pretty good. They're pretty solid. Yes, there's improvements that continue to need to be made, including availability of instruction. But what isn't as solid, I think, are some of these other solutions, like how we deal with access to signage, traffic signals, how we deal with access to information in the community, like street signs, building signs, and then how we deal with information access in transit. We have pieces of the puzzle in place, but how do we get the puzzle filled in is what I think would be good to talk about, and how do we decide how to set some priorities for the actions that we ought to be taking. And then along with that, addressing some of these things, some of these questions about technology. Are handheld receivers of various kinds the answer? Is a platform that delivers a blindness-rich information environment with a handheld receiver built by AT to really specialize and focus on that environment, whether it's for GPS purposes, for signage purposes, for audible signal purposes, the answer? Or is the answer to build the technology into the environment for use by everybody, including visitors of vision impairments and people who do not have vision impairments but who could still make use of the technology? And is that investment likely to happen on either platform, the environment one or the individual one? So I think those would be some fun things that I would be interested in, not only fun, but I think hopefully instructive for all of us, in having some conversations about where we go with trying to make our community more accessible writ large. Jean, Bernice?
I want to start out by I just want to mention three things, Paul, that I think it would be really helpful if someone could compile, and it would be really challenging to do this, but compile a list of accessibility features in systems across the country. For instance, in Washington, D.C., all bus stop signs are on channel poles so that you can distinguish that pole from any other pole that's on the sidewalk. In Santa Clara County, where in Northern California, every pole where a bus stops has a raised sign that says bus. It's in raised print and braille. And if multiple buses stop at that stop, then it gives numbers of the buses that stop there. What was the third thing I was going to say about that? Just parenthetically, Paul, you'll find this interesting. You know the embedded lights in the metro in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
When Roger puts his hearing aids on telecoil, he can hear them clicking as they're coming up brighter.
There's some value in that, I guess,
yes,
right?
Yes, so, yes.
Sure he finds that useful as well.
But I don't know how difficult it would be to ferret those things out, but those are some of the things that are currently out there, and maybe they work well for some people, maybe they don't work well in some systems, but if people knew some of the things that were being used, they could advocate more effectively.
One of the cool things that any of us could do is to set up a website to gather that. People could just simply feed that kind of information in.
Okay.
The examples you just gave, for example. So any community then would any person would have the ability to put that in. It's sort of the wiki of. Mm-hmm. Of community and transportation issues, and then someone else could come in and say, well, yeah, but that doesn't work that well, or it's that was the way it was 10 years ago here, but it's not true now, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, I can certainly take it back and see whether we'd be interested in developing something like that at AFB. There might be others who would be interested in developing that kind of a website. It's a pretty easy thing to start, and it would be cool because we'd be sort of in charge of putting up that information, and it would be talking to each other about what works.
I think this is working. A little slight different thing before the audience jumps in. The stop announcements. Both this organization, the California Council of the Blind, and to some extent the American Council of the Blind, the reason I say the hesitant is it's they're working on it, a position. We pretty much have taken a position that we want all stops to be announced. Not necessarily every intersection that you're going along, but just knowing the stops so you can develop a cognitive map. And I totally agree with you when you said, gee, you ride a route fairly frequently, and once in a while it's great to have I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you hear the announcement and you say, as you're daydreaming, you're typing away and you're and on your computer doing work, just to know where you are kind of in relations, and where to get off. It just after a while, sometimes all the turns in the road and when to get up. But when you're unfamiliar routes and that the anxiety you have, like, am I in the right place? And is this thing? And I mean, of course, that is probably, it's really important to have it. And there's a purpose to it. I'm rambling. But, too, is another thing. It's amazing. And just like a route that been riding for the last 20 years. The transit district has been adding, it does not announce all stops. But occasionally, it's sort of like, they occasionally ask, integrate something brand new. And it's, and I've just learned some streets I didn't know existed. And then they take some of the others away, and you wonder why. No logic to it. I guess what I'm going to get up to is, because when I've been the last few years on American Public Transit Association's ad hoc committee to do a stop announcement in dealing with the transit industry on that. And that's been quite an interesting experience, positive and negative. And the thing is, there are consultants out there who say, you don't need to know all these stops. Every few miles is sufficient. You don't. And when I've said, gee, at least give us something every quarter mile, they said, well, gee, that's too frequent. That will disturb our other passengers. And at the same time, we want to use those channels to put advertisements on and give you saturated with all the commercials so we can subsidize our transit. And then we'll integrate your stop announcements in between all this other stuff that annoys us. I guess the bottom line is I've been trying, even talking to Project Action, which I'm on their National Steering Committee, to see interest about getting some research funded to develop, to find out about a cognitive mapping and how much do we really do we need to develop that cognitive map to get a sense where we are and to be able to use that later on. And I've done outreach to different people and a lot of researchers, and there seems to be a feeling, yeah, there's a great need to be done, but no one has known if anything has been done on that subject. I feel it needs to be done, but, of course, funding is always the big issue, and now it's not even better. But so, I don't know, after all that, if you can respond to something that.
Well, I tend to fall asleep on the bus in the afternoon, and I have had a few occasions where those streets didn't quite wake me up the way they should have. The changes. I did a conference a few months ago where we were talking about the use of technology to solve issues for people with disabilities, and one of them that we looked at was transportation. One of the questions that I thought really did need to be asked from a research standpoint, because we haven't solved, even where things work reasonably well, we haven't necessarily solved these problems, is how much information is enough? Mm-hmm. And how much do we get to a place where it's cluttering for all of us? It's not just a matter of it becoming annoying for people to hear constant stop calling. It becomes too much information for us, too, and that we can't sort out the what we really need to know from the, it's mildly interesting that we just passed whatever street we just passed. The second thing, so how much information? And I don't think we've solved that, and I don't know why insoluble. Doesn't seem like it would be that difficult to research and do a quick get some answers to the level of information that would be really necessary and helpful and useful in a transit environment. Beyond that, for providing better orientation, we may be looking at, and maybe should look at, again, coming back to the use of handhelds, and whether if we're going to move down this road of having more handheld receivers for information, that is a place where a lot of orientation information can be provided to the user, with the user sort of selecting how much, for lack of a better word, verbosity, how much detail they want. The other thing for back to the audio environmental issues, environmental information that we haven't solved, is the characteristics of the systems, the speakers, the delivery, the ability to change the volume with ambient noise, so that in fact the announcement doesn't get drowned out when unexpected noise comes. And again, that's not a difficult thing to solve. It's not a difficult thing to address, but we haven't put very much effort into. I mean, meaning society and policy hasn't put very much information into trying to resolve that issue, so that in fact we could make clear recommendations, if not requirements, for systems for the kind of audio that they need to have, the logistics, the actual design of the technology. And then the last thing is, you know, we left a lot of things up in the regulations for interpretation. Stop calling is one of them that challenges all of us, because there is no clear definition of what are the major route or major stops that need to be called. And so I think we, you know, perhaps should think about putting more specificity around that, to make sure that we have very clear guidance, because otherwise it's too easy for a system to let itself off the hook if it wants to, and it's too easy for it to be at the whims of whoever happens to be on an advisory committee at the time.
If people can raise their hand, and Sarah's going to come and give you a mic, and so you can start participating.
Dan Kaiser. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
I kind of rebel against handheld devices. I think that the public infrastructure and the built environment tends to and public right-of-ways tend to deal with the least common denominator. And I think that's what we have to think about. If it's going to work, it has to be accessible to all those folks who aren't going to admit they can't see well, and all those folks who are running around utilizing the benefits for whatever reason of whatever modification that the visually impaired seek. So I think the more simplistic, the lowest common denominator, and if you can get your handle on that, I really find accessible pedestrian signals in a lot of ways confusing to the way I think and walk, because a lot of cities, they have the audio placed incorrectly, and the go signal is sort of catty corner to where I'm standing, but the speaker is supposed to be facing me and I'm supposed to get it, but I don't really get it. So if I have an environment where things are clearly definable, where there's some kind of a low alert next to my right ear or left ear or on a pole that's right where I am facing the way I'm supposed to go, I can get that. So I think that somehow we have to think about integrating APSs in a way that everybody, in the lowest common denominator, that people can figure out by just hearing it that that's okay to go, and integrate wayfinding in there too, because there's, you know, I tend to live in areas where it's like a grid pattern, and I, as I'm older, I'm going to stick to this grid pattern because I'm, my confidence level, because I'm older, isn't as great. I'm not going to want to go explore the, you know, the roundabouts and the you know, off-angled intersections and that sort of thing. So I really, but if I have to, it would be nice to have a wayfinding device in a non-standard grid intersection. Whereas a grid, and I'm not a big proponent for APSs on a grid. I don't think, in my opinion, APSs are necessary in a grid pattern if the traffic is controlled. And if there's not more than two or three things going on in that intersection. So that's sort of where I come down on it. The simplest, the more simple, the better. And the more complex, there you need more wayfinding devices just by the nature of the intersection. Thanks.
While we're getting to the next person, I'll just note that I know that Gene has talked about this a lot, and he and I spend a fair amount of time not only on the warnings for things like curb ramps, but also on guide strips and guideways for directing, particularly across intersections that are unusual angles or that do triangular things or other stuff that are not straight, you know, straight queue up and shoot intersections. And so, you know, we never got there. We didn't get that set up as a something that would be not only even looked at in terms of potentially moving toward a requirement, as intersections have gotten to be continuously or more complex, it may be something that we need to revisit. But there are, you know, as many logistic hassles as there were for detectable warnings, there are that many more for putting something across traffic streets.
Next person.
Yes, hello.
Richard Moore, Alhambra, California.
I still have some vision, and I get around with it. I don't use a cane, but at some point I imagine I will have to. But I'm short. I'm not 2 feet tall, but I am 5'4". Now, the thing I find about signs that I could possibly read is that they're way about 10 feet up, or 12 feet up, or even higher than that, and I can't see them from down where I am. If they had the signs down lower, I don't know if that would make it harder for somebody that's 6.5 feet tall or what. So, and then as far as all the other stuff goes, you know, I like having a little bit of audio here and there and all the rest of that stuff. But the main thing is just put the signs down lower so they're closer to eye level. Me anyway, but is that too individual a situation?
Are you referring to audio signs, or are you speaking of like tactile signs, street signs. Okay, because right now, you know, the newer ADA requires that the tactile signs be from 48 to 60 inches, which should help. I'm 5'5", so that should help.
What about the printed signs?
Street signs are way up there.
If it's okay, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just working out a bunch of different. I mean, there's you know, if we're talking about street signs, obviously they're there to solve lots of problems, including to be available and unobstructed by lampposts, trees, et cetera, things in the environment, so that they can be seen from a distance. I'm guessing, you know, that that's where height comes in. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there are solutions to that, other than, you know, I know people have talked about, and in some places I think have even experimented with trying to design signage at lower levels that's tactile or visually accessible for street names. But as far as I know, none of that's ever been standardized, even in not in requirements for sure, but I don't think even in a practice.
No, and I think I think that is actually leaning to an argument for a handheld device, GPS, to tell you the intersection. I personally would like to know where I am at every intersection, and also the street address, you know, a tactile. But I know realistically you can put the signs, but there's no standard place you can do it. And then even if you put the tactile sign here, how do you find it? So, yeah.
The printed sign is often at an angle where you're looking into the sun, therefore you can't see it. Roger's always making fun of me because I step out in the street and then with my monocular trying to see what the sign says.
Next person.
Okay, my issue is a little different. This is Andy. I have a transfer point that I deal with on my way to work, and I was sitting here while everybody was talking, and I was counting, and there are eight different bus lines that stop there from four different transit systems. The bus stop is an entire block long. Now, I can be standing at the bus stop pole, but sometimes the buses come in groups, and there may be four or five buses that come at once, and the MTA in LA is starting to use a lot of these 60-foot long buses, and what can happen is that I might be standing at the bus stop pole, but the bus that I need might be four or five buses back. Now, I can identify the bus in front of me in various ways, either if they have an audible head sign, or if nothing else, I can ask the driver or ask somebody who's standing nearby. But if my bus is the fourth one back, there's no way I can independently know what it is. You know, some people know me because I'm there every day, and they might say, "Oh, here's your bus," and they'll, you know, say, "Take my arm," and they'll take me back to it. But if it wasn't for, there have been many times that I have missed my bus, and, you know, had to wait 20 minutes for the next one, and maybe I might have missed the next one too, because it might be. And I've talked to the transit companies, at least I've talked to Santa Monica Transit, and they've said that there is no rule that says that the driver has to pull up to the bus stop. They can make their stop wherever they can make it and go on, and they do. And so I guess I'm wondering what can be done about this situation, because I know it affects other people and other, like downtown Los Angeles is the same situation, and other places as well.
I thought there was a I thought there was a requirement, and I don't, in the regulations, about having to ensure that buses in that situation do pull up to the stop. But I could very well be wrong, and I could very well be misremembering what I think is there. And I even think it got to a sort of a specific thing of when it's two or three or four. I don't know. Or maybe it was just something we proposed. I honestly don't remember. Probably should have read the regs before I came. But it's a real issue. You're absolutely right. And even if there is audible announcement on the outside, you're not going to hear it that many buses back for sure. Certainly not going to see it. I don't, you know, and I would the GPS handheld system work in that instance? At least you'd have a shot at knowing your bus was there. The problem is they pull out a line and, you know, move on because they think they've cleared the riders that are interested in that bus. So short of requiring, and maybe this is the thing we need to do, is to just simply get back and say, look, they, in that situation where there's multiple buses at a stop, they simply have to stop at the stop and make sure that they've cleared the stop. Because it's, I don't think that it's only an issue for people who are blind or visually impaired. My guess is it's just as true for people with mobility impairments who simply can't move fast enough to get back to that bus that's two or three back. And so it's this, you know, here's a place where I think we've got some potential allies. And, you know, it's gonna frustrate the systems, but I know they're also working in many instances to try to clear up, to try to use technology to prevent bus stacking at stops as much as they can. So, you know, obviously it's in the transit system's interest to not have that happen too much. But maybe that's the way, the road we need to take is, let's go back and check and make sure, and I'll take it on myself to do that too. But if there isn't a clear requirement, then let's, you know, maybe that's a place we need to work. There's a lot of interest. It's 20 years on. ADA's anniversary is next July. There's a lot of interest, I think, in relooking at some of the regs.
Charlene Ornelas from San Diego. Actually, San Diego has a couple things that would be very helpful. One is we have a policy with San Diego Transit that calling stops is signalized stops, well, controlled intersections, time points, transfer points, the first stop after a turn, and any stop that is requested. That works real, has worked quite well. Again, you, as long as you have humans doing it, you have some errors. We also have a policy that when there's multiple buses, that they're to follow through in line, as opposed to, you know, going out and around and pulling out. So at least we have a complaint, because it's against a policy to call it in. It is, there is a complaint on it. As long as the person has a visible disability, people who are blind or visually impaired and don't use canes, think about it. You don't have a sign on your forehead that says, I am a blind person, so stop in front of me. You look like the general public. So the drivers can't tell you from somebody else, which is, you know, you want to look like other people, but there's also, when you don't use a cane or a dog or something, there is a responsibility higher on your part that you have to identify yourself. One of the problems that I see and needs to be, and what Denise was saying would be helpful, is there are some things in the regs that are just suggestions, and there are some things that are requirements. One of the arguments that I came up with for people who, bus drivers who, or companies who don't want to call stops, because I went up against the union boss in San Diego, it is the law that you call stops. So I asked him, okay, it's the law. So that means that if you guys want to run red lights, you can, because you can, it's okay to break the law. And I shut him up. But it would be very helpful to have a resource so people could tell, because there's also a lot of information coming out now with these reader boards that are electronic. But the sight of public's getting how soon the next bus is, if there's a delay in the buses, if there's a problem, I don't get that. And I keep getting told, well, that's not a major part of things. That's just a little extra information. I keep telling them, I have the right to that information also. And it would be helpful if it was more clear in the regs that pertinent information includes, you know, time, you know, what the sighted public's getting.
Yeah, good stuff. And the more I listen, the more I think this idea of a wiki where we can start gathering this stuff is really a good idea, especially if y'all... It's only going to help if y'all will contribute to it, though. So,
Charlene, just out of curiosity, how has San Diego defined major intersection?
Traffic signal or, you know, traffic signals? That it's called
a signalized, okay.
Signalized or controlled. They call them controlled intersections. Every time there's a traffic light. And to add to that, because the drivers go,
I didn't know I was supposed to go that one.
They got some tape that is blue, white, blue with the ADA colors, and stuck it on every sign they're supposed to call. So when they go, I didn't know I was supposed to do that, there's no excuse.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, from dependent transit district to transit district, and also the consultants, you know, that's one thing some of us have said, you know, major intersection, it's usually, there's warrants for a signal there. So that'd be a stop. And a lot of transit districts don't define it. They feel they're too close to one another, especially if in your high density downtown communities like DC or Sacramento and so forth. Thank you, Charlene. Yeah. Next person.
Artis Bazin. I have 2 points. It's basically intersections that I find it very frustrating with the turn right on red, because I get to intersections and I can't always tell when the, you know, if there is a light, if, you know, when it turns red, because the cars are always turning. And also, if there is a stoplight, they have them, they are so short, especially on streets that are 4, 6, 8 lanes wide, you get a quarter of the way halfway across the street and it changes, and the traffic is supposed to wait for you, but they don't. They're just flashing either side of you, and you're scared to death. You don't know what to do. Should I go forward, you know, stand still, or whatever? And both of those are extremely frustrating. And I don't know how to solve it.
Well, you know, there's a couple things. One is that I think, regardless of and I think Dan's right, that audible traffic signals are not the answer to every problem with getting across an intersection. They can't possibly provide all of the queuing info that we would want. And there may be, and this is back to my point about, is it the right technology? There may still be work that needs to be done to address some of the issues about placement, signal direction, that audio direction, that kind of stuff. But certainly, so one thing is for sure in those environments, and I even worse than right on red for me are the damn left arrows, because I don't know when they end. I mean, and so I can't stand those intersections because there's so much chaos. So audible signals can help sort out some of that. The other thing for the specific situation you mentioned, I don't know that we're going to get to places where there's national standards, but for sure, most communities are at least receptive to listening to citizen input for the ability to have traffic signals that, when a pedestrian activates the signal, times longer so that the pedestrian can actually clear the intersection. A lot of these streets are designed because there's intermittent flow, and so when you've got a major street and a relatively minor street intersecting, they don't want the minor street to have the traffic flow that long because it's holding up our God-given right to move in our cars quickly and efficiently. And so But I know that there are communities who are sensitive to the fact, and again, this is not just a blindness issue. There are plenty of folks who don't move through intersections that quickly and who are unsafe because they're simply not allowed enough time to clear the intersection as pedestrians. And I know that communities are increasingly sensitive to that. There's an increasingly vocal movement, and ACB has been part of being a part of this pedestrian movement that is pushing back at some of the ways communities have put cars so much more over pedestrians in terms of access generally. So anyway, the only thing I would say for all of us is to get active in pushing our communities to ensure that pedestrians, all of us, whatever our ability and disability, can clear intersections and that there's adequate time. And I don't know that we'll get to a national standard for that, but certainly there's a good place for community work.
Hi, this is Donna. With the accessible pedestrian signals, in a way, I'm concerned about if we do get to a national standard, because then they won't have any of the talking at all, because they'll want to have all the different languages and they'll say it's too expensive to do that and all that good stuff. So That does concern me. I really am pleased with our city. They do listen to the community. We have the signals that have the vibrating arrow, and they also say the street name and everything. And you know, I can compromise on getting rid of the countdown. You know, our seniors and people in our city do say that they like it because they have all the information. But as long as we know the street and you know that it's safe to cross and so on and so forth, it you know, we hate those left arrow intersections too. And in our city, we do have accessible pedestrian signals at you know, intersections, some intersections that have those left turn arrows, so it eliminates the stress. As far as the annunciators and calling out stops, in LA, the policy is to, you know, call them out. We have the annunciators, but the technology is such that when you get in the middle of the concrete jungle and so on and so forth, they turn off. And, you know, that's a bit difficult. I never realized how stressed I used to be when I would ride a bus until we started getting those announcements. And I thought, wow, what a difference, you know. I know where I am all the time. Yes, when they work. But, you know, I thought, wow, that's how it is to ride a bus and not have so much stress. The handheld devices, I'm really concerned about that because not everybody can afford the latest and greatest gizmo and gadget. And I think somebody stated that, you know, you already have your cane or your dog, and then, you know, you have your cell phone and so on and so forth. And maybe if they want to move toward handheld devices, if they can do something that can work on any cell phone, because most everyone has one. Now, I'm not saying everyone has one. You know, I would still like something to just be directly built into the environment so everyone could access it, whether they're, you know, whatever economic level that they're at, and not have something else to carry. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Back of the room.
She's calling at 10:30.
Hi, Lisa Gordon from Sacramento. I've got a few points. First, I am a GPS user, and it's wonderful. I've had mobility training since I was a little kid, but it's never been easy. It's never come. The spatial stuff has never quite just clicked. One thing that I wonder if people could do in an organized way is it's possible to add your own points of interest. And for those of us who are GPS users, if someone just started some sort of an organized campaign and could get people together, it would be really helpful to know, okay, here's the sidewalkless part at this intersection. Or vice versa. In terms of handhelds, if it could be, I would think not everybody can afford a GPS or has a rehab counselor or whatnot. So making things based on a handheld, you've got to get handhelds to everybody, not just people who are connected to the blind community. And another thing that seems to be affecting us a lot is the transit cuts. If you were gonna do a wiki, one part of it that might be really cool is a section where you could give people space to talk about what the transit is like in a given area. Because I mean, we're actually moving because we're concerned about the transit cuts in our area. Just to give blind people an idea from other blind people. Okay, the transit, if you don't live in downtown in this area, then your bus service will generally stop by 7 and paratransit stops by 8, so that we as blind people can make the most choices. And maybe as a final point, maybe you could talk about what the process is to go about lobbying for an audible signal in your area.
Thank you, Lisa. Anyone else?
Go ahead.
Mary Lou.
Okay. Mary Lou Baracco from Los Angeles. What are you doing about the diagonal crossings? Because that is a problem. Also, the train stations, subways, as well as the Metrolink stations, you go over there and there's no way of knowing if you're on the right track or which way. There are directional information on like a ticker, but you can't read it. It'd be nice to say, you know, what train number, which way it's going, because it can be very frustrating. There may be no one around taking that train, and you have no idea. What is the situation? What can be decided or a solution, even with the diagonal crosswalks? I didn't even know. I was at UCLA, and it can be very, very frustrating.
Thank you. Next.
Yes, Darrell Wilkerson from San Pablo. My issue is crossing some of the main streets that are diagonally. I have a problem of veering, and so my concern would be, since the streets do intersect each other as you cross them, would be to get as much clues as possible. So would it be possible to get the information by putting some kind of a tactile strip to give us that information? Place a tactile strip on the street in the crosswalk as you're, you know, crossing the street, you know, on the cross line. Especially for those
guide strips,
crossings that have that, you know, those intersections that do have that, those intersections that intercept. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are.
As I say, I think we talked a little bit earlier about the importance of, or the work to deal with guide strips and of some form, which we didn't succeed at, and Gene might say another word about that in a second. Going back to, I think it was Lisa who asked about getting APS installed. Didn't ACB have somebody had a resource on their website about efforts to do that and ways in which you might work with
AER has, as well as ACB, and we've actually even had a workshop here in training that and gave handouts that Janet Barlow had okayed and said we could use some of her stuff. So there are some materials out there. It's a very valid point on how to advocate for your accessible pedestrian signals.
Maybe it's a good thing to take back and find a way to make that more visible.
Yeah.
Put back on the CCB website or something.
Yeah, and I will also bring it back to the attention to Deputy Grubb, who is working on for the Environmental Access Committee for ACB, updating the pedestrian handbook, and I know that is something is planned to put more materials in there on the subject. Anyone else?
Just a couple of quick things. One is, I think the website information would be really valuable. I know that when we went and told them we need audible signals in different places, they come to me and say, where do you get them? And I had no idea, you know, until I made some phone calls. So being able to refer them to a website would be great. I want to give some kudos to CCB and all the blind organizations, because since we've become more organized in Merced, I'm Margaret Garcia from Merced. Merced has the notoriety of being one of the worst pedestrian safety cities in the whole country. And so we've been working very actively in trying to make it safer for our blind and visually impaired in our community. And just putting CCB on, you know, the email as, you know, part of the local chapter has actually gotten some things moving. So from developers now development has kind of slowed down, but we actually were able to pass that a new signal and a new development that the developer was going to have to pay for an audible signal on any lights that were being installed. That was approved by the Planning Commission. So putting our, you know, saying we're CCB and, you know, it helped get us noticed. We had a blind couple that was trying to get an audible signal on a light that was right in front of a school. In other words, it was not a grid kind of thing. It was just in the middle of a street, a very busy street, for over a year. And about 4 months ago, we got involved. And it took 4 months, but we finally got an audible signal on White Cane Safety Day, of all days. The one thing I would like to ask is there any kind of regulation regarding where the push buttons should be located to even change, even whether it's audible or not? We have some, those pork chops to me are even worse than some of these other kind of
yes.
things, where you have to cross this right turn thing that nobody ever stops at, and then they've got that push button signal on that little island in some intersections. That to me is like the worst place in the world to have them. Is there any kind of regulation where they're supposed to be?
Do Google and get the California Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. It has specifications all from the federal government with the California amendments, and one of those things is the location of the push buttons too, and with from an accessibility perspective. So it's the California Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and it's a manual that the California Department of Transportation has issued, and it has the California amendments with the federal. We can take one more.
My name is Marcy Knudsen. I'm from San Luis Obispo. I've talked to a lot of transit manager officials about the problems with automated calling out the bus stops, because where I live, there's a huge portion of bus stops where they call out BMW dealership or IHOP or McDonald's or whatever they're calling out, as they think that's the name for the bus stop. But none of those locations are going to be listed on a city map. So when they're refusing to give a street name or street intersection for the name of the stop, I don't know where I am. And that's especially more of a problem if I'm traveling in a city where I've never been to the city before, but they're calling out Walmart instead of a street name. So there needs to be more uniformity as to what information they're giving when a street intersection is called out. And this is relevant to everybody traveling in any city, whether they're an American or foreign traveler or whatnot. It's useful to know where a Reebok store is, but it's not appropriate to have Reebok be the name of the bus stop.
Thank you. Important what you just said. And somewhat we were trying to do with APTA to get that standardized. Not fully successful, but definitely Paul's taking notes on that. I just want to make one comment and then let Paul say a closing comments. And perhaps he might be able to offer some way of people funneling more of their statements and comments to him so that he can utilize that for possible development of national policies. The other thing is, and one thing you're going to hear Sunday morning, is that another mode of transportation is the concept from the Netherlands, shared space. Elimination of all the queues, reference points, where our colleagues in the UK have done a lot of work, research on it, and it's where you basically have motorists, bicyclists, and pedestrians all sharing the same space. No separation. No traffic signals, no sidewalks or anything. It's all free-for-all, and with the idea that you make eye contact.
that is starting to, there is places around the United States, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, Florida has a few places. It's starting to get there, just like the roundabouts. And the reality is the roundabouts and shared spaces are not going to go away. We just have to work with the people for access to see that we at least have the safety in there and the safety space. Paul, thank you very much, and give you the opportunity to say the last
word. Gene and Bernice, thank you for inviting me to be on the program. This takes me back. It's been a lot of fun to explore these issues. I will say that I think it's no anybody who tracks the American Foundation for the Blind's work. We haven't done a lot with transportation probably since the early 90s when we were up. When other people at the time were partners with ACB on detectable warnings and transit regs and ADA. We've kind of moved away from transit. It's something that nags at me. It bugs me. I don't like the fact that we've done that. I know we've had to focus, and that's been part of the reality, that we haven't done as much with transportation and accessibility issues. I'm going to take back some of the suggestions. I appreciate the conversation we've had here. I have a great deal of true love and respect for the work that ACB does and the work that CCB does on transportation access, because I know as a blind person I've benefited from it across this country. And so I appreciate it. I think you already have the best and sharpest people working on this task. And if there's a way in which we can be more helpful, again, acknowledging that AFB has had to make some decisions about our focus, and we don't do as much with this issue as I might like us to. And so I'm not going to promise that we're going to be a whole lot more involved in it than we have been. But I am going to go back and take a look at some things in that we might be able to do within our core competencies in the leadership rhetoric, one of which is a website. And I think, you know, maybe there's some tools that we can make available through that to strengthen what we're doing across this country. And who knows, maybe we can start putting a little bit of muscle to help what the excellent work that ACB is doing in advocating for a number of transportation safety and access concerns. So I appreciate the opportunity of have been with you this morning and to sort of go back through the time that Gene and I got to spend years and years ago working on these topics, and it was a lot of fun then, and it's been a lot of fun this morning.
Thank you.
Just while we're waiting, it's just a few more minutes, but this is the opportunity to ask paratransit eligibility questions. You know, why isn't my commuter bus does not have paratransit, so forth. How should I complete my application for reestablishing my eligibility to provide? How much information should I provide? How much do I not need to provide? And also, as more of these paratransit companies are going toward functional assessments, what your thoughts are about functional assessments from the visually impaired and blind perspective? The honor system is going away, where you can make a trip reservation and say, okay, you got it or you don't got it. Now you're going to be being quizzed, like, do you really need it? And why can't you take routes such and such and so forth? You're going to have to defend yourself because they're all financially hurting. And now the power is going to be at that person. The call taker is going to be given instructions how to quiz you. So that's the opportunity now. See if Marilyn's online now.
Hello, Marilyn.
Hello. Sorry for any delay. It was difficult to get through.
We apologize for the inconvenience to yourself.
Oh, no problem.
This is Gene Lozano, and there's, about 30, 40 people in the audience? And, pardon?
A good size audience.
Yes, and Marilyn, at our head table is Bernice Kandirian, who is the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision.
Hi, Marilyn.
Hello.
And then alongside her is Paul Schrader, that you know, vice president of programs and policy from the American Foundation for the Blind, who just ended his presentation.
Hey, Marilyn Golden, how are you?
Good. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Long time. I wish you were here.
So do I.
So I'm going to give just maybe a few little words about your background, and I think you could do more justice to yourself. But Marilyn is the policy analyst for Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, which is based in the San Francisco East Bay. Marilyn is was very much active in the development, the passage, and the implementation of the ADA, which is well known nationally and internationally for her work in access in the area of transportation and architectural barriers. From 1996 to 2005, she was on the U.S. Access Board. Many of her things include, and this is where Marilyn and I have had some working interaction in the last few years. It's with the American Public Transit Association's Stop Announcement Committee, and she's been very active with AFTA. And her and Dredith have done a lot to do with paratransit eligibility, and she's done put together a lot of publications, books on ADA paratransit eligibility. And Marilyn is not going to give a formal presentation on the subject, but she is going to cover and give a few words, and she's honored us by agreeing to be able to answer all your questions you've been storing up. And as I was getting them from you all, I've been forwarding them to her, so she has some sense of some of them and probably will respond to those. So let's give a hand to Marilyn Golden.
Jane, thank you very much for the kind words. Let me just first check on, is the volume and everything okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you today by telephone hookup. I especially want to thank Gene for his fine efforts and coordination of this workshop. Is everything fine with how this is going?
Yes.
Sound-wise? Okay, good. I just, it's a little hard to gauge, but it's just great to be able to be with you at least in some way, so I appreciate the chance to do it like this. I thought I would begin with a couple of the questions that I received in advance. Then I'd like to go over some of my suggested question areas, which I sent to Jane, and address the ones that you indicate you're interested in, and also the ones that match up with other advanced questions I was sent. And lastly, if we have time, I wanted to finish up the advanced questions. So first, a couple of the questions received in advance, possibly slightly reworded, but hopefully keeping the question's essence. Oh, I heard a beep. You guys still there?
Yep.
Okay. The question was, why doesn't the ADA require complimentary paratransit on commuter bus routes? Well, first of all, then we have to say, what is a commuter bus route under the Americans with Disabilities Act? And by the way, the same principles apply to commuter rail as bus, for example, the Caltrain. Commuter bus service means fixed route bus service that is characterized by certain characteristics. One, service predominantly in one direction, only during peak periods. Also, routes of extended lengths and limited stops. A good test of it is it designed to serve the public all along the way, all along the route over which the vehicles travel, or is it designed to pretty much get people from the beginning to the end of the route? If there are a few stops near the beginning or the end, it could still be a commuter route if most of the lengthy route does not have stops. That is, if it runs closed door along most of the corridor in question. I think the reason transit that is not designed to serve the public all along the route, but rather to more or less get them from the beginning to the end, I think the reason those routes are not required to have complimentary paratransit under the ADA, this is my understanding. I'm not the one that wrote the rule, but I believe it's because of reasons of efficiency. When there are a lot of stops in a relatively close area, then paratransit can be a shared ride service and still achieve a relatively reasonable efficiency. But the longer the distances, the less that is possible, and the costs go up even higher than they are for where ADA paratransit is required, which is already fairly high. Now, to be clear about that statement I just made, I don't mean to suggest other than my wholehearted support for ADA paratransit. But even at its best, it is undeniably an expensive service to run. And that, I think, is why commuter is not required. A corollary to this is that there were a couple of questions asked if a particular route should have paratransit, and is it a violation if it doesn't on a particular day or on a particular fixed route service. And I'm not familiar with either of the services this was asked about, but the answer would depend on what I said before, of whether the service meets the definition of commuter service that I gave. If it does meet it, then the absence of paratransit is not a violation of the ADA. If it does not meet it, then it would be a violation. But even if it does meet the definition and does not have to have paratransit, it is still completely required to be accessible and meet the ADA requirements in every other way. And there was another advanced question about how much medical information to share in the ADA paratransit eligibility process, and whether the eligibility process may require a doctor letter. And I may be starting off the workshop with a bit of a bang here, because Dredd's response may seem counterintuitive from what you would expect. Perhaps, like you, we tend to approach questions about disability by trying to restrict them. We ordinarily concern ourselves with the right, exclusively with the right of the person with disability to receive services without sharing a lot of personal disability information, particularly because in some contexts, such as employment, the shared information can be the basis for discrimination. But ADA paratransit to us is a little different. While in theory we have the same concerns, the general tendency that we have noticed, and I don't mean to say that there are not counterexamples, I'm sure that there are, but more often than not, we have noticed that revealing more information is more likely to achieve eligibility where eligibility is appropriate. That is, the person legitimately experiences real obstacles to using the fixed route system due to their functional limitations because of their disability. And yes, a doctor's letter may be required, but there is also a rule in ADA paratransit eligibility that the transit agency cannot charge fees, and that includes hidden fees. So if what is required becomes a cost obstacle, that is ground for not having to provide it. At this point, I hope it's okay if I just point out a couple of suggested areas for questions. Now, you all can ask me anything you want about ADA paratransit, but I do have some areas that I think might in particular be helpful, and I can address is it okay if I just mention those, Gene?
Sure.
Okay. The first one is door-to-door service required in ADA paratransit, and what is origin-to-destination service, which is the term where this is relevant. And this was actually asked in an advanced question, so I may just come back after I list the topics and just address it. The second area I mentioned was on-time performance in ADA paratransit. Questions such as, why does ADA paratransit so often fail to be on time? What are the factors that cause this? What should transit agencies and advocates do to ensure better on-time performance? And actually, I got a couple of on-time performance questions beforehand, so I may just address those anyway. So please remind me if I forget on those two points. A third recommended area was about no-shows in ADA paratransit. What are the rules that transit agencies are required to use to protect rights of people with disabilities? Another area was telephone hold time in ADA paratransit. Just how is this supposed to work? What standards should transit agencies be meeting? How long should somebody have to hold? And there's some other important issues in paratransit phone service that I think would be interesting to talk about. Another area might be conditional eligibility. How is it supposed to work? And here's perhaps another, I don't know if it will be counterintuitive or not, but if you're interested, we can talk about why Fred of my organization thinks that if done right, conditional eligibility could be a positive thing for the disability community. Another idea might be, and I'm almost done with my list here, about appeals of eligibility denials. Why are they so important? What is required during an appeal, and what do you do if, this is a very important question actually, what do you do if your allowable time for an appeal has elapsed? What are ADA paratransit rules for visitors from a different city? And lastly, but certainly not least, how do I file a complaint if my transit agency is not complying with the ADA? I could take questions from the floor, or I could address the couple advanced questions I got that were in these areas that I mentioned. Whichever you think, Jane, or...
Let's try to answer questions first, and then,
yeah, good, okay.
Then you can integrate some of your responses to some of the others. Okay.
Was that for me to go ahead or for you all to go ahead?
We're getting to a mic to somebody in the audience.
Very good.
Lisa Gordon, Sacramento. My question is, when the paratransit is actually better than the public transit, with this, you know, functional assessments on the phone, I have some concerns about people with relatively little education about disabilities with a lot of power in their hands over individual situations. What if the reason that you can't take a bus to a given location is the bus has stopped running, and that's why you need to take paratransit?
Marilyn, go ahead.
Are you talking about the reason for an eligibility denial, or are you saying that you're told to take paratransit because there's no fixed route at the time?
When we are not an eligibility denial, but when you're making a reservation and the reason that you are taking paratransit is because the bus service is no longer running that late. And they say, well, why can't, and people were saying as an example, well, why couldn't you take the 84? And the reason that you couldn't take the 84 was the 84 had stopped running that late.
Maybe, Marilyn, this is Gene Lozano, just to help provide some clarification. The Sacramento paratransit service goes beyond the ADA. It's an operation during the hours that Sacramento Regional Transit fixed route curtails in some parts of the operating district, so that's part of it.
Well, if a certain bus route... The basic requirement for ADA complementary paratransit is to provide what the ADA finds to be complementary service if you can't use the fixed route due to your disability. So theoretically, the first choice, in a way, is using the fixed route service. If your disability prevents that or makes it so difficult that it's tantamount to preventing it, and you don't have to keel over before you get there. It's not supposed to be that strict a test. There's what's called a reasonable person test. If a reasonable person would think it was a reasonable effort to make, that is then, you know, you have to be eligible for paratransit. That is the basic rule. However, transit agencies can provide additional service if they want, and some do. And that is you know, one way to see that would be that it's a good thing. I mean, if you're being given service that non-disabled people don't get, your transit agency is going beyond the ADA. And people in other cities would envy that. I'm not sure. Another nuance that was in your question, and I'm not sure if this is what you meant, but what I also may be hearing is that does fare transit have to be provided once a bus route is, say, discontinued? So, for example, if there used to be a Route 84, but it's no longer running at all, then ADA complementary paratransit through the corridor that route ran is no longer required. It is legal to cut paratransit if the fixed route is cut. If the issue is the fixed route stops running at night, say the fixed route stops running at 7 at night, then paratransit in that corridor may also stop running at 7 at night. And if they continue to provide it, then you're kind of in a zone beyond the ADA, because the ADA doesn't even require that. So they're, of course, allowed to provide more service.
The question I have is paratransit, you make your reservation and then they tell you, well, we can't pick you up. It's well after your pickup time. Say your pickup time is after an hour or so, and then they call and they say, well, we're not able to pick you up. Do they have the right to do that? And the second part of the question is, you're on the vehicle after 2 hours, what they say. And I was on a vehicle for 3 hours or more, and I called to complain. They didn't do anything about it. They said, well, we'll check into it. But they didn't do anything about it. I want to know, are these two, is it legal for them to do?
Well, these are really good questions about paratransit on-time performance. So maybe I can talk about the factors that address them. The issue of lateness, I mean, lateness can stem from a lot of different things. But generally speaking, there's a number of factors that affect the timeliness. One is that when you make a reservation, and some of this you know, I'm sure, you have to be given a reservation within an hour of your requested pickup. However, it's also important that on-time drop-off be considered. And a number of determinations by the Federal Transit Administration, which enforces this part of the ADA, has made it clear that the drop-off time for many rides is more important than the pickup time. And so the booking of a ride has to consider your appointment time, so to speak, whether it's the doctor or whether work starts at a certain time or the movie you're going to starts at a certain time. So that has to be taken into account. So, okay, so that's establishing the pickup time. So let's say your pickup time is established. There is usually some kind of on-time window. It should be no greater than 30 minutes. Sometimes it's 20 or 15. It varies based on where you live, but it might start at the pickup time and run till 30 minutes after, or it might start 10 minutes before the pickup time and run till 10 minutes after. I mean, it varies within a 20 or 30 minute amount. Somewhere, you know, centered or with one end or the other on that pickup time. That is when they're required to come. And if they don't come then, that is late or early. And either late or early, I mean, 5 minutes, I wouldn't sue over it, but significantly late or early, like you're talking about, is not supposed to happen. And if it's within their control, it could be a violation of the ADA. Certainly, if there's a significant number of trips like that, it is a violation of the ADA. They didn't pick you up, and then they're an hour late, and then you call, and they say, we can't come and get you. That's a missed trip, and a significant number of missed trips is also a violation of the ADA. We would argue that a late trip or missed trip that was within their control is a violation. When within their control means, is it a result of a decision to have too few vehicles or too few drivers? Because capacity is something within their control. Things that are not within their control are things like, you know, extreme weather event that could not have been predicted, or major power outages across the city, or things that are truly unexpected. Even a freeway backup cannot be considered outside of the transit agency's control if it's one that happens regularly, because then it is a knowable thing and they should plan for it. So that's the issue of the lateness. And the second part of the question, I think, was about the length of the ride. The way the length of the ride is measured in terms of ADA compliance is that you have to look at how long that ride takes on the fixed route system. And you have to consider the time it would take. Let's say the fixed route system, you would use the bus to get there. It could be that you would use the train, such as in Sacramento if there's a light rail system. But just for the sake of argument, let's say you logical way to get there would be on the bus. You have to count the time it would take someone to get to the bus stop, because that's a legitimate fixed route aspect of the trip. Then the time it would take to take waiting for the bus stop has to be counted. Waiting for the bus. Then the travel time on the bus. And then the time it would take to get from the bus to the destination. If you add those together, that's the amount of time it would take on the fixed route system. The paratransit time should not be significantly longer than that. So let's say that the fixed route trip with all the segments that I mentioned would take an hour. Then if the paratransit ride exceeds, perhaps an hour 20 minutes or an hour 15 regularly, certainly that would not be considered comparable. The Federal Transit Administration has sometimes received a complaint on this subject, and they have exhaustively examined whether the transit agency's trips take longer than fixed route. And they found that in over 50 rides, 47 of them took less than the fixed route time, and 3 of them took 10 to 15 minutes more than the fixed route time. And they had deemed that agency not to be in violation. And that's how they measure what they consider to be too long a time on the road for a paratransit trip.
My name is Christy, and I have a couple of questions. First question, and this is regarding Omnitrans Transit in San Bernardino. They have refused to provide any information to us in accessible format. And we have subscription rides, and they seem to make up their own rules. They did send out a pamphlet to my home that I cannot read, and I've asked for the information to be given either electronically, on tape, on their website, whatever. I can't get accessible information. The second question is, what is the policy on courtesy call for pickup?
Could you repeat the second part?
What is the qualification or the policy, the bare minimum policy on courtesy pickup, courtesy call for pickup? In other words, I work in a state hospital, and it takes quite a while to get out. It also takes quite a while to wait for the access van, and some counties will provide the courtesy call where they will call you like 5 minutes before they're arriving.
Yes. Okay. Well, certainly alternate formats are required. And I think what I heard you say was that the initial letter or something like that was in alternate format, but not the book that gives the that applies to the subscription service. Certainly, upon request, they have to provide that in alternate formats. If not, it's a violation of the ADA. There's a limit on that requirement, but it's hard to imagine that it would be very difficult to reach it. I mean, it would need to be an undue burden, which is defined as a significant difficulty or expense. given the resources of the agency. And, I mean, that's a summary of the definition. And certainly any transit agency big enough to even require ADA paratransit is going to not, it's not going to be an undue burden for them to provide a piece of written material in alternate format, in any kind of standard alternate format. Certainly have to give them enough time to do it or whatever. It sounds like you did. I mean, that's a factual question. But should be a reasonable, it should be reasonably prompt because they owe you access to the same information they owe everyone else. In terms of what you called courtesy calls, I've heard them called call-outs. Some transit agencies have the technology which allows them to have what's usually a computer-generated phone call to let someone know that their vehicle is 5 minutes away. That is not required by the ADA. What the ADA requires is origin-to-destination service, and that means that it addresses the question that whether only curb service is required or whether door-to-door service is required where the driver would come to the door to let you know they're there and or help you out, and the same thing in reverse at the other end of the trip. And what we've learned about that question is in 1999, the U.S. Department of Transportation, which the Federal Transit Administration, which enforces this part of the ADA as a part of the U.S. Department of Transportation, DOT put out a piece of guidance on the ADA called Origin Destination Service, and it, in essence, said that if a person's disability necessitates it, the transit agency must provide additional service beyond the curb for that individual. The driver has to come to the door. They don't have to go through the door. They don't have to go inside. They're allowed to retain what is referred to as effective control of the vehicle, which usually means not past a certain distance. It can be 100 feet, 200 feet, or, you know, each transit agency can define that. It needs to be within a reasonable amount, and they don't have to go out of sight of the vehicle. But they can be required, if your disability necessitates it, to come to the outer door, you know, to assist you in other ways. There are limits on that. They don't have to undergo, strongly unsafe conditions. They don't have to incur what would be a direct threat to them or you. But they don't have to do it just to let you know they're there. If your disability, I mean, take myself for an example. I'm disabled. I use a wheelchair, an annual wheelchair. I can get around quite well. They would not be required to come to my door to knock just to let me know they're there. With my particular disability, I would need to go to the curb and be ready during the pickup period or keep an eye in the window. A lot of transit agencies established a 5-minute pickup wait, and they won't wait more than that. I mean, it's true that people have to be ready, and that is some inconvenience. Sometimes it can be particularly inconvenient in bad weather. I mean, if your disability means that you really can't be out there, that might necessitate, you know, the door-to-door component. But paratransit can legally incur some inconvenience, just as riding the bus can be inconvenient, too. I mean, I don't think anyone adores public transit in the sense that it might be more convenient to go another way. But paratransit is supposed to be equivalent to that, but not necessarily better. So it's all really dependent on what your disability necessitates. But there are many people with disabilities who really do need the door-to-door service. But not a courtesy call and not just notification that they're there. That they're there.
Dave McElroy, Visalia, California. And first of all, by parenthetically to add to what you're saying, when I was first involved in all this, we were told, and in no uncertain terms, that paratransit only guarantees us the same lousy service that everybody else gets. That's what we were told, and I've always remembered that. Therefore, and as a result, as a blind person, I do not choose to use paratransit in the main. I don't need it. I don't utilize it. But this leads to my question. We live in a small county, and our county has said, in essence, we don't provide paratransit. What we provide is dial-a-ride service. And basically what they do is they'll provide a service to anybody who wants to, you know, pay the fare. I can't remember what it is now. And they just have a reduced fare for disabled. Is this even legal?
Well, it depends on the circumstance where you live. I should say as a general comment on our logistics here that for each of you, there's things I'm not hearing. I'm not always hearing your name, and it could be we're buddies, but if I don't acknowledge it, I feel like didn't. But from what I understand of your question, you don't have a fixed route service.
Yes, we do have a fixed route. Yes, there is a fixed route.
Okay.
Yes, there is a fixed route. It's a small system, but it is a fixed route. We're a city of 100,000, and it's probably a 10 route system.
Uh-huh. May I ask, did you say again where that is?
Visalia, California. V-I-S-A-L-I-A. It's Tulare County. We're in Fresno. It's the next major city south of us here on Highway 99.
Well, a fixed route service, unless it's a commuter service like I spoke of about a half hour ago, this requires ADA complementary paratransit, meaning it has to meet all the requirements of ADA complementary paratransit. That's clear in the ADA. There are some smaller services that were provided through a somewhat different funding arrangement. And for some period of time, some of the providers of those smaller services would argue that complementary paratransit is not required because it's funded by a nonprofit, or it's a different kind of funding. But if it's publicly funded and it's a fixed route service, it doesn't matter where the money comes from or how many pots it flows through or what they are. It doesn't matter if the entity that provides it in the final analysis is even public, as long as the funds are public. Well, that's not always true, but it sounds like it is publicly a public entity that provides it. It does require ADA complementary paratransit. So the quote unquote dial a ride that they say they do, if that's what they do, it needs to meet ADA paratransit requirements, and they can call it, you know, if it acts like a duck situation, they can call it, you know, fried chicken if they want to. But if it's a demand response service that is pursuant to a route service, which is required to have, it needs to meet ADA paratransit requirements. Now, if they want to add non-disabled people to it, if they want to say, we'll also pick up anyone, they can do that. It's not addressed to the ADA. They don't have to limit it to paratransit eligible people, but the part that isn't for paratransit eligible people doesn't have to apply, but the part that is does. Now, they may also choose to provide a spam response service that goes beyond where the route goes. And that would be additional. And that, unfortunately, is not held to these rules. These rules are specifically for ADA complementary paratransit, which is paratransit provided to people with disabilities who cannot use the fixed route system. And the statement you started with, which I'm proud to say was originated by the lobbyists for my organization, and I won't use the back language because it speaks in very colorful terms, but, you know, it was, yes, that the ADA entitles us to the same level of mass transit. It is an equivalent. I mean, some may argue twice fixed route fare is equivalent, and it really isn't. But ADA, and we pushed against that, we lost that point, but ADA defines that as complementary, and in many respects it really is just what the fixed route gives you and no more. I don't necessarily support all of these limitations. I feel that my job is not to defend the ADA, but to explain it. Some of it we do, some of it we don't, but my job here is to explain what it does say.
Okay, Charlene Ornelas, I have two questions. The first one is, we have a one-hour window for reservations. So I tell them I want to be picked up at 9 o'clock in the morning. They say, well, we can't pick you up then. We'll pick you up at 8 o'clock. Okay? That's
right.
The hour window. But then I get a call that night going, well, we can't pick you up at 8. We're picking you up at 7. We have the hour window. And so they're sneaking in a two-hour window, and I'm wondering if that's legal under the ADA in the paratransit. The second question.
I would say that it is not. That pickup time, assuming you're going by pickup time as opposed to by drop-off time, I would say that if you're going by pickup time, you know, that's how you arrange the ride, that you wanted a certain pickup time, that's not legal. Now, if you were going by drop-off time, and they told you, we need to pick you up at 8 to get you there at 9, and now they say conditions are such that we need to pick you up at 7 to get you there at 9, that would be legal, if it's true. The length ride would still need to be comparable to a fixed route ride.
What's happening is our people are arriving at their destination because that's what they're doing. It's not because there's a problem. They're telling you the night before, and you end up sitting an extra hour at your destination because you tell them, I want to be there at 9. They'll say, we'll pick you up at 8. So you're there at 8 because they picked you up at 7.
Yeah, and that is a big issue, these early drop-offs. And the Federal Transit Administration is not happy with them. It's citing them as, you know, certainly in anything other than the tiniest numbers of them are being cited as something transit agencies have to change when the Federal Transit Administration does compliance reviews. It's probably, you know, I mean, we would suggest that they shouldn't get to there more than a half hour early. Certainly there is one compliance review that made a finding. A finding is made when there's a problem in the eyes of the Federal Transit Administration who are doing the compliance review. And they cited and they did a made a finding on an agency that was getting people there an hour too early. I mean, it really is serious. I mean, for example, in very cold weather conditions, which parts of our country have, you know, much worse than California, unless you're up in Tahoe or something, it can be pretty snowy there too. People were getting to work an hour before the building opened. I mean, with vulnerable health, even not vulnerable health, you know, this is not an acceptable thing. So early drop-offs are not appropriate. It sounds like that agency needs more capacity so it can pick more people up at the peak time. The one-hour window thing is checking the transit agency. The up to a half hour, roughly speaking, pickup window is protecting them. And past that, you know, significantly early or significantly late, we know that significant numbers of them are against the ADA. We would argue that a single one that was within their control is a violation of the ADA.
Okay, my second question is two agencies in San Diego County providing paratransit with the same language in the law that says that this is for people who use wheelchairs, that it is recommended that people go onto the lift backwards and come off forward. One agency says it says recommended, therefore if you have a chair that's going to, you know, turn in a circle, it's a lot easier for some people to come on forward because you can't twist to see what's over your shoulder, and they want to come on forward. And the other agency says you don't have a choice. It says recommended, you're doing it the recommended way. Is that legal under the what's it, paratransit?
For all of ADA transportation, whether crowd or paratransit or private or any wheelchair with the issue under the ADA, it is pretty clear, or it's very clear with the following, that people have the right to enter backwards or forwards according to their preference, unless the transit agency can show, you know, significant safety reason. But it has to not be a generalization or a stereotype. It's not for the convenience of driver. It really has to be that they have to show a significant risk of substantial harm, not based on presumptions or generalizations or convenience or myths about what people with disabilities. I mean, for example, if for some reason, which I've never really even heard of, you know, doing it in one way or a number of significant accidents, so you'd have to do it the other way. I mean, that's the level of reason it has to be. Generally speaking, those kinds of requirements by the agency that you have to do that one way or the other usually are violations of the ADA, but they can recommend. But they can't require, again, unless you really show a significant problem. Otherwise, there was the woman who, I can't remember if she's still the president, but was the president of California Disability Rights, was getting off, I think, a lift on Amtrak and needed to go out of the way, and they wanted the other way. She knew her rights, and she got out onto the lift. She would not descend, or she got out halfway, and she would not continue until they allowed her to do it in the direction she wanted. She held them up for hours.
This is Ed Crespin. We had a resolution that the Active Blind Inland Valleys chapter created to create a statewide ID card so that we don't have to have identification for each transit agency. And the reason why is because I travel between San Bernardino and Riverside. Now, if I could use my ADA fixed route system to get to Riverside, then I can take that same bus and get to my destination, because I'm at the terminal. Coming home, though, I have to pay the regular fare because I don't have that ID for that particular Riverside County transit. So I pay the regular fare, then I get down to the terminal, then I can use my Omnitrans. But we really need to have a statewide ID. And the second part to this question is that it has to be so that my disability is permanent, and why does Omnitrans want to reevaluate me every 3 years to find out if I still am blind? I don't get it.
If I may, sorry, were you done?
Yes.
If I may say first, trans agencies are encouraged by FDA to not require re-certification for people whose conditions are not variable. And I would like to let you give me a moment. I'm trying to find. I don't have it in front of me, but research. We're actually developing some technical assistance documents on ADA for transit, ADA transportation for the Federal Transit Administration, which will be coming out within a few months, and we're developing one on eligibility, and it addresses this point. I just wanted to find that section. To eliminate unnecessary inconvenience for riders and to lower the cost of eligibility determination, transit systems that have developed thorough ADA paratransit eligibility determination processes are providing long-term eligibility to unconditionally eligible riders whose functional ability is not expected to change over time. In other words, it's a best practice not redo it if it's not changed, assuming their process is already thorough exit. Thoroughness is a weak for a lot of agencies, and that brings in the whole conditional eligibility issue, which we may want to talk about. FDA also made a finding in a compliance review that even though the ADA permits periodic recertification for anyone, they pointed out that waiving recertification for customers whose inability to use the fixed route is unlikely to change can both avoid cost and inconvenience to the riders. So it's sort of a recommendation. In terms of your first one, I understood that it was about ID cards, but I'm sorry that I could not make out the details.
Excuse me, Marilyn. Ed, clarification, are you talking about fixed route?
Well, I'm...
Actually, the ID card. Are you talking about
the ID card? The ADA, a county ID card for ADA.
Okay, but I'm asking to use it on the fixed route bus system?
Both.
Paratransit?
Both. Paratransit. It's
okay.
Going to be the both because when they certify you for both.
Okay.
So that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. The thing is, and excuse me, Marilyn, there is, and maybe Marilyn has the citation, and if Dan Kaiser is in the audience, we've totally forgot, but this organization did get a bill through the California legislature that required that fixed route operators recognize one another's ID card for disability discounts on the buses. And it's in the Public Utility Commission regulations. And Dan was pushing for, you know, new legislation on this, and Dave Wilder at a meeting pointed out, but you folks already got that. You already got in the Public Utility Commission. So it is there. Now, paratransit is a different story, but fixed route, there is something already in the law, and then I've confirmed it with Sacramento Regional Transit that is true.
Dan is not in the room.
Are you saying that it applies to paratransit also?
It just applied, the ID card was just applying to a fixed route only.
Okay.
Ed is saying that that's one card that the transit district issues for paratransit eligibility as well as a discount on the fixed route service.
Right.
And wanting to use it elsewhere.
So they're required to give reciprocity, I think they call that. If that's a state rule, then they should be doing it. I'm not well informed about rules, but it sounds entirely plausible.
Lisa Gordon from Sacramento. When I was using San Francisco Paratransit, my disability didn't require door-to-door service, so it was curb. And they had a big problem with not seeing me and me missing the ride because they didn't see me.
Did they go to the door? They just, like, passed you and went to the door?
Well, no. It was an apartment complex, and it was big, and there were lots of different buildings and lots of different parking lots, and I stood right outside my apartment complex where the curb would be, and they had my cell phone number, but there were several problems where they said they didn't see me, and then they said they didn't know that I was blind. Would you have suggested that I insisted on door to door in that case, or how would you suggest to handle something like that?
Well, part of good origin to destination service is not, as their petition suggests, it's not all physical assistance, but simply identifying the passenger is an important part of the origin to destination service. That is the door-to-door service necessitated by a disability. We had one very prominent disability advocate who was blind in Washington, D.C., who a lot of you may know, Julie Carroll, told us a story, a very similar story, and she was waiting for a paratransit ride, you know, endlessly, and at one point a kind passerby asked her if she was waiting for a paratransit ride. It turned out her vehicle was right in front of her, and they had arrived early, and, you know, she came out, and there, you know, and that link clearly should have been made by the driver. In the situation you're discussing, it as so often happens on ADA paratransit, it's a little bit tangled up. Another issue, which is the whole issue of large complexes and really identifying, you know, front door, back door, which corner, and all of that. And, you know, good operational practice in ADA paratransit is to get all that stuff very carefully recorded and transmitted, and for the vehicle operator, that is the driver, to know where to look for it, so it's so they have it, and, you know, for it to be confirmed, going back to the reservation call, for it to be confirmed, asked, confirmed, transmitted, you know, good training for the driver so they look at it, follow it. If you have a problem with the transit agency, you know, if you were not asking for door-to-door service, but you have that problem, you can request the next time as a way to address the problem. It's also recommended that certainly for a transit agency says you're a no-show, it'd be recommended that they call your number. That's, again, a good operational practice. So it's not a requirement, but very often, what we have found is that good operational practices that the best transit agencies are doing, I won't say that they are necessary for compliance, but what we keep finding is that the ones that comply are the ones that do these things. So it is almost tantamount to close to something that, you know, if they're not doing, going to have these incidents that have an effect of a failure to comply.
Hello, Marilyn. My name is Nellie Emerson, and my question is regarding transfer points. I live in the northwest corner of Riverside County, and our paratransit agency, the Riverside Transit Authority, does not have any transfer points for the adjoining county, which is Orange County. And so when an individual that uses paratransit needs to go to Orange County, they are instructed to take the Metrolink or to take a fixed route bus, which the closest stop to where I live is not accessible by fixed route. And I want to know if the absence of transfer points to an adjoining county is legal under the ADA.
It may be. I don't know the specific situation, but the, you know, if, and I didn't hear every single part of that clearly, but if two different transit agencies with two different service areas cooperating, or if, you know, they're next to each other, they're adjacent jurisdictions, they don't, but it's not really all one service area, or if they're linked by a segment that is only on a fixed route without complementary paratransit because it's a commuter service or something like that, there could be a failure to have links. I mean, as one of those earlier questions was saying about loud transit, I mean, you know, the automobile is almighty in the U.S., and our system as a whole has plunged so much resources into everything related to driving, and in comparison, fewer resources by far into public transit, and particularly in lower density areas outside the big city. There's such a lack of good transportation. I would probably need to know more about the specific situation.
Hi, Marilyn. This is Ken Metz, and I live in San Gabriel, which is part of the L.A. area, or right outside of it. The biggest problem that I'm finding, we happen to have had a class action lawsuit back about 10 years ago, and because of that, we were able to develop a service animal subcommittee within our access services area, and I am the chairperson of it. One of the real problems we've had is that we have the wheelchair vans and that has this long seat in the back, well, two people in the back. Some of them have a jump seat, some don't. And then the wheelchair is up sort of in front. They can get two chairs in there. We've had our service animals, we've had probably five or six who had to be retired because the way either the traffic was and in many instances the way the drivers drive. We've had five or six of those dogs being thrown up against the ramp during turns or stops. Now we're holding them on a leash, but they still slide. I have been trying to work with this company for 9 years with our committee to get mats that would be put down when the service animals are in the vans. We wanted them to be in the vans because they're really hard to carry if they're going to be that type of a mat with a rubberized backing, and we look at that because some of the flooring on the van gets very hot from the undercarriage, and so we wanted the dogs to be comfortable as far as not being super hot. It's very difficult on them, and we also don't want them thrown around the van when stops are made. They've been giving us a lot of difficulty there because they're concerned with liability, with safety, and all kinds of things. And I'm just wondering if we're concerned about tying down the wheelchairs for passengers, which we absolutely should be concerned about. I think we ought to show close to that amount of concern for service animals as well.
This is an issue I'm not familiar with. It's interesting, and I would need to maybe get back to you or something. One question I would have would be whether being thrown against the ramp is more injurious than being thrown against the side of the van for the animal.
I'm sorry, the ramp is inside. Is that what you're asking?
They have edges that stick out, I guess.
Well, the ramp is attached to the passenger side,
yeah,
where the sliding door is. And when they make either a left, well, normally when they make a sharp left turn, the dog slides sideways into that into the ramp.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I would need to check into this. I don't have a response. I mean, I think it sounds very legitimate. I can see why it's a concern and important, and it should be there. I, in a way, can also understand a little bit the transit agency's resistance, only because, I mean, I'm not saying we know this whole field or anything like that, and we're always learning new things, such as right now. But I just have not heard of it, and I don't know how often it comes up, and
Well, basically, what we're trying to ask them to do is to keep the mats in the back of the van where the tie downs are and just use them when a person gets into the vehicle with a service animal.
No, I hear that.
Okay, yeah.
And I think that, I mean, another example comes up. I mean, there's other things like this. For example, child safety seat. Does every paratransit vehicle have to have one so a paratransit rider can bring their young child? I mean, what has kind of come about is that the transit agency, I mean, we say, and the best transit researchers and sort of policy investigators are saying, the agency is required to either have one or allow the individual to bring their own and use it. But to make the rule that every vehicle has to have a mat or a child safety seat is a requirement that would have significant consequences for the agency. And so these are things that have not become required. And the one about the mat, not one I have heard before. It sounds like it's about the side, but also the floor. You mentioned the hot floor. And I just, other than giving this comparison to the other issue that I did and what has been said about it, it's not exactly a requirement of the law. It's being interpreted to be illegal if the transit agency refuses to either provide a child safety seat or you let you bring and use yours. Now, it's hard to bring a safety seat. It's a lot scary. So some people would say, hey, that's not good enough. All I can say is no one has required agencies to do it, and the folks that I work with mostly think it would be, you know, I mean, the more, you know, the more we hang on this, no one has required it. That's all I can say. And I would like to check into the MAT situation and maybe get your email address or something like that. You can send it. No. Gene, forward it to me, or
it
wishes to, or whatever.
I'll get Ken's email and forward it to you, yes.
Sure. It's an interesting question. I'm glad you raised it. I just can't help you further on. I wish I could.
Any other questions?
Yes, there's more. Microphone on?
Oh.
This is Marcy Knudsen. I'm from San Luis Obispo County. I am currently a college student there, and I am attending college classes on three separate campuses. During the past 2 years, I would say approximately 80% of my paratransit accessible use on those bus systems. The only reason why I've had to take the paratransit instead of a fixed route service is because the fixed route service for the city of Paso Robles refuses to call in passenger transfers to county buses for the county where I live. So it's not possible for me to transfer from one system to the other system on a regular fixed route service. So since the fixed route service is preventing me from using the fixed route service, I have to use the paratransit as an alternative, not because of mobility issues or not because of whether I can navigate a regular bus map or anything, but it's just the fixed route service preventing me access to the fixed route service. And I haven't been able to get anyone inside my own county to deal with why are they refusing to call in transfers. But I don't know if this is a reason that the paratransit could say, well, why are you not just using the regular fixed route, and then tell me that I don't qualify for paratransit because it's not a mobility issue.
Well, I believe you're saying that there's two route systems and you could get from one to the other if you can go on a certain paratransit service or demand response service, but they won't let you because your disability doesn't qualify you. I think may fall back under the sort of lower density, you know, or outside the ADA issues. You know, lower density areas, different services that don't always match up. And the ADA doesn't require where it isn't there. I mean, the ADA, again, has the job giving you, based on disability, what others have without having a disability. So I don't know if this, you have, for it to be required under the ADA, there would have to be a situation where you can't do something because of your disability that, say, your non-disabled neighbor can do on public transit. Or it would need to be, you know, something like the entering the vehicle one way versus the other, or of a provision of service issue. I wish I could say that it's a violation. I can't help put it that way. We might need to know more about it.
And we're welcome to contact you if we have more questions, you know, to give you more information about my situation. I mean, if you had more information, do you think you could be able to assist me with dealing with this?
Possible. If you wish to send it, I'll take a look. It's, you know, real long. I may ask you to try to pull it down. But, you know, sure, I'm open, certainly open to looking at that. It doesn't sound like it.
It's not an issue of the paratransit refusing to give me service, but since there's going to be new questions about why do you need to use paratransit service, if the people making the reservations are going to have more power to question why and question whether or not they'll book a reservation, then I need to know if this is going to be used against me.
I'm also actually having trouble hearing every detail. So, Gene, you or someone may want to relay.
Okay. First thing, the concern is that because of the economic picture affecting all the transit industry in California. And there's more scrutinizing the honor system for paratransit, for giving you a ride. A lot of the companies now are getting more into really questioning you whether you do need to use the paratransit and refer you to fixed route. The lady's problem is that, and she's going to have to correct me, is that there's two. The paratransit is not the problem. They're serving her. That's working. However, it's not. She's using paratransit, not necessarily by choice. She'd rather do fixed route, but there's a city transit and a county transit. They're separate, and I don't know, possibly the county one, you have to flag down the bus, I don't know. But they won't, the one company will not have their dispatcher contact the other dispatcher to say, we have a transfer from our city bus to the county bus, let your driver know that this person will be waiting who is blind or visually impaired. So it's the thing she's trying to get is that is her reason, because she can't rely on just waiting there and then that the bus will stop and pick her up. It may not at all. So she's trying to make certain because of the complexity of her schedule.
Well, this,
is that correct?
Yes.
I think this.
That's right. It's the issue of the city buses refusing to call in transfers to the county buses.
The city transit won't call the county transit.
Should I go ahead?
Yes, please. I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. There's a little bit of an echo, so I couldn't tell if it was someone else talking. Now that I hear it better, this could be an ADA situation, but for an entirely different reason. They're not required to call each other. Different agencies are allowed, they're encouraged to coordinate, they're not required to do so. But any fixed route system, it doesn't have to be like a big city system, any fixed route system is required to do two kinds of things in the area of announcement and identification. One is more well known and another one is not well known by either the disability community or the transit industry. The more well-known one, of course, is stop announcements. And, you know, on the bus, stops must be announced within particular categories, such as major destination points, transfer points with other fixed routes, any requested stop be announced, and stops have to be announced at several along the route sufficient to visually impaired and other people with disabilities to orient themselves to their location. But in addition to the stop announcement requirement, on the route system, there's a requirement for the route to be announced at any stop that serves more than one route. The stop announcement requirement that I said a minute ago is an inside-the-vehicle thing to let riders know where they may need to get off. But the route announcement is an outside-the-vehicle thing aimed at passengers who want to get on. Because let's say a visually impaired person is waiting at the intersection of Broadway and Elm Street, and the 54 bus goes by, and so does the 64. Well, they are not going to necessarily know if it's a 54 or a 64. They can't read the sign on the bus announcing what route it is. And that's why there is this requirement that either in an automated system or the bus driver calling out the door if there are anybody, not just someone who, you know, looks blind or whatever, but if anybody is waiting, this is 54. And if there is a stop, there's both the city and the county service, and you're at the stop, but the driver simply isn't stopped because you're not maybe waving your arm to something because you can't see them. That's this route identification requirement is supposed to accomplish. Now, the question comes up that a single agency might know its own routes better than other agencies' routes, and so one could argue, do they have to know that somebody else stops here too, or only where we stop, our route stops? You can make an argument that if any route stops there, they should at least make identification. I don't know if that helps you, but it's the closest thing that I can think of that might. I mean, if the a paratransit service for people with disabilities that you don't qualify for, I mean, if it's ADA paratransit, which means, or I should, just to be thorough, let me call it ADA complementary paratransit, which is the full name, that is being provided pursuant to a fixed route system. Then they have to follow eligibility rules that have to do with whether your functional impairment limits your ability to use the fixed route. But if it's just some additional other kind of paratransit or mile rider, you know, service for disabled people that's not provided pursuant to a fixed route system, they can have whatever rules they have, and if you don't meet them, they don't have to pay. I mean, the ADA would require that they can't include a wheelchair user by not having a lift, or they can't, you know, fail to assist you on, or, you know, a variety of things like that. Can't make you go on the lift one way versus the other if you use a wheelchair. But, you know, they have to announce the stop. But they don't have to give you eligibility. I mean, maybe there was a program started specifically for people who need kidney dialysis. You know, because that was an urgent need in some region and there was nothing to serve it. You know, and if you don't need that, they don't have to give you the service. Again, unless ADA paratransit that has very specific rules.
Go ahead.
Yes, this is Preston Moses. I'm from San Pablo, California. When I fill out my application for paratransit, I felt offended by one of the questions they asked me, and that was your weight. And I felt quite offended, and I just said, not applicable when I answered it. I still got my application approved and everything. But that was my first question. The second question is, when you fill out your application, and they are they required to let you know that you were approved? Because I had to call them and ask them if I was approved.
Well, they certainly have to let you know. They have to let you know in alternate formats if you need them and you've asked for them. And they have to let you know why it's denied, the specific reason. So you bet they have to let you know. In terms of asking about your weight, I was going to make a probably unnecessarily sarcastic remark, not at anyone's expense here, but at the agency, that, you know, it's a good, I mean, that you got approved is better than some, in that we've seen agencies that, you know, you skip a question, they have grounds for denial. I mean, we've really, you know, distorted kind of reactions to minor irregularities in applications, presumably as a way to deny people, and FTA is saying no, no, no to those practices. But in terms of what you said specifically, yeah, sure, I don't want to say it either. I mean, I would say that they are asking that question in order to do something which really should be separate from eligibility, and FTA is saying the agencies should be separate, and that is they're trying to figure out if in the circumstance that you happen to be a wheelchair user, do you and your wheelchair, you know, considered as a package, meet this so-called common wheelchair definition? that has so inappropriately applied and misapplied under the ADA, which has to do with the length of the chair and its weight with the person. And there's a 600-pound limit, which the Access Board is proposing to change, not much, 660. We certainly argue that the ADA's requirement for modification policy is that if a transit system can accommodate a person that doesn't meet this definition, they should take it anyway. But it should be a separate assessment. It shouldn't be part of transit eligibility. I don't know if they is legitimately needed for any other purpose. I could get back to you on that. As I said at the beginning, I mean, there's a lot of intrusive questions on transit eligibility. If they're doing their job right, they aren't always doing, and I understand that.
Yes.
They can't, now giving them more can't hurt you. If you really are, should be eligible. But let's just say, and I'm just going to throw this in. Let's just say that,
on the right-hand side,
according to any of the things we've talked about, they're not complying. What can you do? And the easiest thing that you can do is, well, you can certainly file a complaint locally, but the easiest you can do that specifically under the ADA is you can file a complaint with the Federal Transit Administration of Washington, D.C., an ADA complaint about your transit agency. And there is a form that you don't have to use, but which you may use for doing this. It's on the FTA website, which I am virtually certain is quite accessible. I send the link to the form, Dean, and I don't know if it's all sort of connected in terms of Hack Feather's email address. I can also describe to you how to navigate to get to that form, or we can send anyone that form access for it. You can find it on the FDA ADA website, and that's at a pretty easy link, which is you have to go to www, and I'll say this more than once, www.fta, which stands for Federal Transit Administration, .dot, which stands for Department of Transportation, .gov, or gov, for government agency, and then /ADA. I'll say it again, www.fta, Federal Transit Administration, .dot, Department of Transportation, .gov, /ADA. And that's the FDA's ADA website, and if you, you know, poke around on that site, you'll find a bunch of links, and one of them is to, I think it says something about how to file an ADA complaint, and you write the form. You know, fill it out thoroughly, you know, include any attachments or other information that help demonstrate the point you're trying to make, and send it to the address it says, and it will get investigated by the Federal Transit Administration.
Thank you, Marilyn. I just would like just to ask Joel, did your question get answered? Joel? Okay, then it's 12 noon, and I want to thank you very much, Marilyn, for your excellent presentation and answer addressing these. It helped us a great deal, and I will forward to you Ken Metz's email address about a service animal question he had. And thank you very much for giving your time, and let's give Marilyn a hand.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Have a great conference.
Okay, thank you. So that ends our this morning's presentation, a workshop between the Committee on Access and Transportation and the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. Thank you very much for coming, and we'll do another workshop for you at the next convention. Can't promise anything, but I think from what I heard earlier, we may want to invite some of the people from San Francisco Department of Public Works, how they're implementing the structured negotiations on APSs, which was got the city to put APSs and that normally we couldn't get them to do it and without a lawsuit. And that's Lainey Feingold will probably touch upon a little bit of that during her talk. So thank you very much, and have a good lunch.